Something Enters, submitted by Seth.
Hey, I'm Step, and I thought about posting since I joined the group, since this is a true story. True story, 2018. I was visiting my aunt. One day, it was very hot and the sun was killing me. Even though it was 11 a.m., I felt tired. I decided to nap on the floor, but my body had a sense of something. It wouldn't let me fall asleep, even though I was very sleepy. As I was drifting in and out, I tried to open my eyes, and I could see something entering the door, coming in. I couldn't see the figure of it. It was not human, though. I tried to wake up, but my body was frozen stiff. I couldn't move, but I tried, by all means, to wake up. Finally, I did, and the figure was gone. I think this creature wasn't bothering with me. I was so scared of the thing that night, I decided to go sleep with my aunt. Anyway, that's my story. It's short. Hope you like it. Thanks.
Thank you so much for submitting your story. And if you want to submit your true paranormal encounter, you can do that at the Facebook group, which is at True Scary Stories with Edie. Welcome, uglies. We got another episode of True Scary Stories with Edie. You guys have, if you don't know who this is, if you don't know what this is a podcast where two comedians read scary stories, make fun of you, have a blast at everyone's fear and expense.
Yes.
So if you're not into comedians talking about scary stuff, probably not a good podcast for you. Get out.
Go to fucking stupid stuff.
Whoa. I don't think I've ever heard you swear on this.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry.
There's children listening.
I think this was sleep paralysis.
That's
what this sounds like.
It sounds like you had sleep paralysis. I've had that before, too, and it is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the first episode of my sleep paralysis. I saw a figure that looked familiar, and my mind was like, oh, that's my friend. But then they started dancing crazy and dancing demonically, and I was like, oh, shit, I'm asleep.
How do you dance demonically?
He was dancing like this. You know, kind of like Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
So, like creepily.
Creepily. Yeah, but then it got more demonic because it was like the arms started shifting out of place and shit like that. Like, I was like, oh, this is weird.
I wish you guys could see this dance that Nick is doing. You're really moving and grooving. Okay, let's get to our next submitted story. This story is submitted by one of our uglies, Victoria, and it is called Watch Out.
Hey, guys, I wanted to share another story with you all. When I was little, probably about 8 years old, my dad was married to a woman named Kathy. Kathy had three sons that lived with us, and the two that were adults and lived on their own. Now, Kathy hated me and my sister. She was a shitty person anyway, so it wasn't a surprise. We had taken care of one of her older son's dogs. The dog's name was Roscoe. He was a purebred pit bull, beautiful dog, and 100% loyal. This story happened in the summertime. My three stepbrothers who lived with us were at the father's in Connecticut for the summer. My dad was out of work, and my stepmom was out there with friends. My sister was upstairs in her room. I was watching TV in the living room and got up to get a drink from the kitchen. Roscoe, who had been cuddling with me on the couch, suddenly shot up like a rocket and grabbed my shirt. I jumped back, thinking he was either playing far too rough or trying to attack me. "Roscoe, what the fuck?" I snapped. Roscoe jumped and placed my hand in his mouth, gently, however, and refused to let go. He tried to tug me back to the couch. I tried to pull my hand back, telling him to drop my hand. This was not normal behavior, but I wasn't sure what to do. Then all of a sudden, in the kitchen came a loud bang and a bunch of metal hitting the floors. Roscoe finally let go, and I went into the kitchen to investigate. The knife holder had fallen down onto the floor. One of the butcher knives was stabbed into the wooden floor. Had I been in the kitchen, I would have been in the way of the falling knives. Roscoe is the greatest dog I ever had. I miss you every day, Roscoe. Thanks, uglies. Hope you like my story.
Shout out to Roscoe, the hero of this story.
Yeah. Was he a fortune teller or did he sense, like, a demonic danger?
Uh-oh, here comes the dance again.
What do you think?
The demonic dance. Dogs have a sense for things like that. I didn't know that they predicted the future.
Yeah, so he sensed something in that room.
Yeah, he sensed an evil presence. He couldn't predict the future.
Yeah, okay.
Speaking of dogs that save people, check out All Things Scary, where our episode should be up right now. We just put it up on YouTube. It is about Courage the Cowardly Dog.
Yeah, the whole show and the darkness behind the actual town.
Yeah, I didn't know it was based on some true events, so we've really get into the history of Courage the Cowardly Dog. So when you're done listening to the podcast, go to YouTube and check out All Things Scary. Our new episode should be up.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into what we're talking about today. Which is cults. We are doing cults today. Yay. All right, uglies. Let's get straight into it. This first story is called Part of the Family.
In middle school, I made friends with a very strange girl. Her name was Kay. She was very short and horribly skinny, even though she told me that she was eating properly. She would speak so low, it was really hard to hear her, and she seemed to have some mental issues, like depression or anxiety. Even though she was stranger than my other friends, she was really kind and nice, and we had a lot in common. She even introduced me to my first boyfriend. One night, Kay and I were talking about him when she said, "I'm worried about him." I asked why. She answered, "I did some black magic, like I usually do, and I saw that he was one of Satan's puppets. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think so." I didn't say anything, but my thoughts were like, "What the hell?" She then said, you're special, but there's something wrong with you. You have a dark shadow on your heart." I thought she was joking, so I didn't really mind this. One afternoon, she asked me if I wanted to come to her place to play some video games. I never had the occasion before, so I said, okay, and we headed out. To be honest, even from the outside, her house creeped me out. After introducing me to her mother and sister, we went to her room and started playing. She kept her door open, which wouldn't have been noticeable if it wasn't for the fact that after an hour of playing, I saw a shadow in the hallway. She told me her father was coming upstairs. As he passed Kay's room, he peeked inside. I greeted him. He didn't answer. He just shook his head and left. It made me really uncomfortable. After 3 hours of playing, I told Kay that it was time for me to head home. She told me that she wanted to give me a quick tour of the house before I left. As we walked around, I noticed a door she didn't say anything about. I asked, "What's this room?" She told me, "Stay away. My dad summons demons in this room." Now I really wanted to go home. This place, this family, it definitely was scary. I went home in a hurry after she told me about the room. The next day at school, I saw Kay, but I noticed that there was something wrong. I asked her if she was okay, and looking me dead in the eye, she told me, "Do not ever come to my house again. I say it for your own safety." I was really shocked and asked her if I did anything wrong. She replied, "When my dad met you, he tried to read into you. You pushed him away like nobody else did. I mean, with your mind. You pushed him away when he tried to read you, like you had some sort of strong psychic ability. He told this to my uncle, and now he wants you to be part of us. He wants you because you have power. He'd do anything to have you on our side. That's why I tell you to stay away. You seem to have some power you don't understand or don't even know you have. If my uncle and father manage to grab you, they'll use his power against you to make you weak and use you all the way they want. You'll become their puppet. Please, I want you no harm, but they do. Don't come again. Next time, I swear they won't let you leave that easily." I was so shocked. I just said, "Oh, okay." A mutual friend later informed me that Kay's family was part of some obscure cult. I don't know if all of that was true or not, but I was horribly scared that something might happen if I wasn't careful. I slowly pushed Kay away from me and avoided to go near the house. I don't know what she's up to now. I'm sorry, because I really liked you, but dear freaky friend, you and your creepy family, let's not meet again.
Wow. This is definitely, I feel like this is definitely a true story.
Yeah.
There's so many weird cults. In fact, when I told my friend we were doing this episode on cults, he goes, "Oh, you mean like Marilyn Manson?" And I was like, "I didn't know Marilyn Manson."
Well,
had
not
a
Marilyn
cult.
Manson, Charles
Manson.
Can
I finish the story?
Oh, go ahead.
Jesus
sorry.
Christ.
Sorry, okay.
That was it. Okay.
So, I guessed it.
Anyway.
I'm a detective, Edie Gibson.
Okay, whatever. Let's move on to the next story. Nick and I just had to turn on the lights because we got scared because Nick thought he heard a noise. So let's get into the second story, which is called A Learning Experience.
Back in January, I decided to become an ordained minister, as I'm hoping one day to become a priest. I'm an Eastern Greek Catholic. That doesn't mean I am Greek, that just means I go to an Eastern Greek Catholic church. A few months after becoming ordained, I got everything I needed to really get my ministry going. I posted my ministry and what I do on Facebook. I put that I can do exorcisms, house blessings, weddings, baptisms, etc. In my description, I put that my ministry specializes in helping people who don't have a faith or belief system to follow yet. I get a message from a couple asking if I would come to where they lived overnight and perform a house blessing / exorcism. Just to clarify, an exorcism does not always have to involve someone who is possessed. It can involve a particular place or object. These people told me that they believe in the devil, God, and such, but they didn't follow any organized religion. I told them that I don't do exorcisms and house blessings on my own. I'd have to bring three friends with me. The main two reasons for that is for safety and to prevent spiritual attacks. They said yes, and I got three of my friends who were devout to the Christian faith. My two friends, James and Kyle, were both Catholic. My other friend, David, was Eastern Orthodox. The couple's house was a little bit further from our local area, so we packed up the RV and drove over to their house. When we arrived, the couple was out on the front porch. They seemed really nice, perhaps a little too nice. I introduced myself as the head minister, and my other three friends were my deacons. The couple introduced themselves as Benjamin and Kathy. While they came over to shake our hands, they stared at the crucifixes we wore around our necks. I didn't think about it at the time, as I wasn't sure if they just thought they looked pretty. Before we began the blessings, we all sat down for dinner. The food they prepared was great. Before we all ate, as it was a custom for me and my friends, we all prayed before eating. However, Kathy and Ben didn't join us in prayer. And when we offered them holy water to drink to begin the blessings, they didn't want to take it. Now, my friends and I were a little creeped out, but we just figured that our customs and our belief systems were a little bit strange to them. As my friends and I began performing the blessing, sprinkling holy water and holy oil all in each point of the house, the couple decided to go into their room. We told them that they could be involved since they were the owners of the house. They said they were fine and went back to their room. Now, you may have thought that after we would have just left, but we felt obligated to help these people with what we thought was a spiritual attack against them. After we finished the blessing, the couple came out and we were told that we were going to stay over since we wanted to make sure that they weren't under any spiritual attack. As we were heading back to the camper, they offered a guest room that we all could sleep in. I'll admit, their house was pretty nice, and again, we wanted to do anything we could to help these people out. We decided to take their offer. They set up 4 air mattresses for all of us, which is going to be a lot more comfortable than sleeping in an RV. Before we went to bed, David, James, Kyle, and I took a look around our room. The room had one closet, a nice flat TV screen, and a couple of dressers so we could put our equipment somewhere. While we were taking a look around the room, I took a look in the closet and was genuinely disturbed at what I saw. In that closet was an old Ouija board, but someone drew a perfect pentagram on all 4 of the corners. There were also small statues of Satan or some sort of demon in a small chest. When I saw all the disturbing satanic items, I freaked out. I took the box out of the closet and told everyone else what was in there, and they all thought what I was thinking. We were all in a house owned by 2 possessed devil worshippers. My friend James took a closer look at the box as I was holding it, and he told me to drop it now. I asked him why, what's up, and he said that it was a Dybbuk box. He told us that the box was the dwelling place of a very malicious spirit that likes to attack and torment the living. Before we all decided that it was time for us to leave, we could hear whispering coming from the box. It said things like, "Get out, leave, go. Get out." We're about to pour holy water on the box when, at the exact moment, Kathy and Ben came into the room. They stared at us. I don't mean out of curiosity. It was a malicious stare. Before excusing ourselves and leaving, we wanted to confirm our suspicions about these two. We all did a possession check on them to see if either or both of them were possessed. David and I went over to Ben, while Kyle and James went over to Kathy. We put holy water on our hands, and we put the crucifixes up to their foreheads. As we got the crosses closer to them, they both screamed at us and said, "Get those things away from us!" We grabbed our things and ran out of that room. Ben pulled out a knife as they began chasing us. We ran down the stairs. We could hear frantic and heavy footsteps coming right after us. As we were running through the hallway near the stairs, I could see a figure out of the corner of my eye. A black figure, a shadowy figure. As I bolted towards the front door, I felt a sharp scratch down my back. I didn't care who or what did that. The adrenaline in my body and the determination to get the hell out of there was enough to keep me going. My friends and I escaped the house and ran towards our RV. When we got in the RV and started it up, Kathy and Ben were both banging on our windows. Ben was also waving his knife at us. I stepped on the gas pedal as hard as I could, and we were out of that hell on earth. As soon as we all got back to where we live, we agreed that we are never doing that again. We aren't taking any more requests that are out of our local area. I also took down my ministry Facebook page and decided that I'm only answering to people that I give my business card to. Now, I rarely answer to house blessings and exorcism requests. I don't know whether that sick couple wanted to kill us or if they wanted to sacrifice us, but I'm glad we didn't stay to find out.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
So that's why they didn't want to be there for the blessing or anything, because they were actually
Satanists or devil
worshippers.
They couldn't
be, yeah, in the room with the blessings. And that's why they were looking at their rosaries or crucifixes, yeah, or whatever they are. I'm obviously I'm not going to heaven. Crucifixes or
a rosary. Well, it was crucifixes.
Whatever.
Other equipment.
What other Jewish people have?
I didn't know why they were drinking holy water. I was like, why? Hey, you want a sip of our holy water?
I know. And now these guys are like, I'm only going to get people's demons away from them who I've met. You know, it's like, yeah. If you're in that kind of line of work, you're going to be working with demons.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you want to be a priest, homie?
Yeah, well, that's how it works. I mean, you can't be like, oh, I want to be a preschool teacher and then never be around kids. Or you can't be like, I want to be a preschool teacher and I don't want to be around demons.
Okay, good. Okay, all right, I like it.
The man in the white suit.
This encounter happened to me just a few days ago. I'll give you a bit of background. I'm a 20-year-old female and a Minnesota native. The story involves four of my closest friends, Amanda, Jane, Kaylee, and her boyfriend Tommy. About 2.5 years ago, Kaylee moved to Nebraska to be with Tommy. So when she visits, we always plan big trips. This particular trip, Kaylee and Tommy came up to visit us during the 4th of July, which is also around Kaylee's birthday. We planned this trip for months. The bulk of the trip is going to be camping along with other fun stuff. We decided to all meet up in Anoka, which is northeast of the Twin Cities, and spend the night there before starting our trip. Everything goes off without a problem, and we all have a great first day together. Day 2 comes around, and we headed to a small resort in Mora, where Amanda's parents have a cabin. After spending the day there, we would head to Osaki's. At Mora, we take the boat out, swim, and just have an amazing time, completely unaware of what the evening would have in store for us. After dinner around 9:45 p.m., we say our goodbyes to Amanda's parents. Kaylee and Tommy and I all pile into Kaylee's Ford Explorer, affectionately named Coppershot, and Amanda and Jane pile into their cars behind us. This is where our nightmare begins. After 2.5 hours of following Google Maps without any trouble, our navigation suddenly goes haywire. It is sending us back down roads, dirt paths, unmarked trails, literally anything but an actual road. The only one of us being familiar with the area is Kaylee, but she's used to taking the main highways, something we avoided because of the holiday traffic. We're coming up on 3 hours of nonsense directions, and our frustration and fear is starting to reach its boiling point. Kaylee is directed down another unmarked dirt path that has a very large "Do Not Enter" construction sign on it, though there is no obstruction to indicate why. Then we directed down yet another unmarked path. One that appears to be someone's driveway. We do as we were told, hoping to find some place to pull off and construct a plan to get out of this mess. As we pull up to the driveway, the air in the car thickens, and despite high humidity and 90 degree summer nights, I get goosebumps and a chill overcomes me. Visibly shaking, Kaylee looks back at me, sharing the same feeling of uneasiness. But the driveway is much too small to turn around. Not to mention, there would be no way to indicate to Amanda, still in her car behind us, that we were planning to do so. We reach the end of the driveway and finally we have a clear view of what we're being brought to. A very old, very decrepit looking church. Its weathered, white boards and wrought iron metal have seen better times. And in the darkness of the night, illuminated only by our headlights, it gave off a vibe that said, "Turn around now." Before I could even open my mouth to say anything, Kaylee's car engine began to whine and shudder. Her 4x4 had seen much better days, and they had actually planned to replace it before coming up, but the timing just didn't work out. Amid the car's protesting, we heard a very loud, very audible thump noise. All of us made eye contact, assuming she must have hit a small animal. Tommy exited the car and made a circle around it, checking for any potential victims on the ground. At this point, we're maybe about 50 yards from the church's double door entrance, the front of the building lit only by Kaylee's high beams. Tommy circles back around to the front of the car to check the grill when he stops to listen. His complexion, normally a lovely middle American tan, fades to all white as all the blood drains from his face. He goes over to the driver's side and frantically knocks on Kaylee's window, a sense of absolute panic overcoming him. He half yells and half cries into the car. "There's music coming from the church," he says as he grips the lip of the glass, the window nearly breaking in his grasp. It was almost as if everything had stopped. The bugs, the birds, the bats, there was almost no sound except for the faint sound of an organ being played coming from the church. I stared out the window at the empty building for what felt like hours. There were no lights on, no candles lit. The building should very well be empty, if not completely abandoned. But the sound poured out from the church, almost as if to intimidate us. Tommy jumped back into the car, and Kaylee made the risky move of turning around on the narrow path, surely getting us stuck if we didn't make the maneuver. As she whipped her poor 4x4 around, I never broke my gaze with the church's doors. Tommy got out to speak with Jane on the passenger side of Amanda's car. At this point, the music was nearly deafening, and the doors started slowly opening. It was happening so slowly, I wasn't entirely sure anything was happening at all, until they slammed open. The thwack noise of the metal handle hitting the aging wood so loud, Kaylee and I heard it from within the car. Tommy was walking back to our car, and I felt the sweat drip on my face, beating down anxiously. I managed to choke out a whisper, "Guys, we should go now." Tommy got back in the car and saw the expression on my face, but I refused to break eye contact with the figure standing in the now open doorway. A man, probably around 6'3", stood in the doorway, wearing an all-white suit. White coattail jacket, white vest, white pants, white shirt, shoes, hat, and what I assumed was some sort of melee weapon perched in his hands. His face obscured by the shadows of the night, but I could just feel his eyes locked on with a certain type of hate onto us. At first, he walked slowly, with intent, never looking anywhere but right at us. I felt my entire body start to shake, and I could see the horror form on Amanda and Jane's face as they saw him approach in the rearview mirror. I wanted to scream, but all I could do was sit in silence. I realized, amid all of my terror, that something was wrong. The music, it was still playing, meaning that there were more of them. He wasn't alone. His slow, deliberate pace turned into a full sprint with no notice, and at last the scream in my throat escaped as he was a mere 15 feet away from Amanda's car. Kaylee stepped on the gas, and Coppershot whined under the suddenly changing conditions, and that cliche horror movie moment felt like it was going to last forever. Fortunately, just as the man approached Amanda's back window, Kaylee's car threw itself into gear and sped down the drive, almost hitting the dense tree line. We cleared about 2 miles in 2 minutes, my heart pounding every second of the way. From what I could tell, He followed us in a chase for about 500 feet and then stopped, but didn't turn back around, at least not while he was still in view. We eventually pulled off to the side and flagged down Amanda, who was going almost double what we were in speed. We all got out of the car and stood in silence. We eventually figured out a plan to get back home. Though it was a lot of backtracking, we did eventually make it to Osaki's. We arrived to the campground 3 hours later than planned. All the friends we were meeting up with were worried sick, but none of us really could speak of what had just happened, or we just didn't want to. Amanda finally just said that we had gotten turned around. We all set up for the night and went to bed, not speaking about it. The next morning was fairly uneventful. The entire day passed without us speaking of the incident. We continued our plans of going to a small family-owned amusement park up near Osaki's. We had fun, go-karts, lots of fun theme park activities, and mini-golf. As we finished up our game of mini-golf, I went to use the restroom. It was a single-stall bathroom, so there was a line. As I waited, I overheard a conversation between two of the theme park employees. One of them were talking to an officer earlier that helps with security around the theme park. The officer told this employee that cult activity had been reported in the local area. Immediately, the previous night popped into my mind, shaking me all over again. As I continued to eavesdrop, the employee mentioned that this group was considered dangerous, and they had been sighted a few times. Every time they were seen, they were all wearing all-white attire. I felt my stomach drop, this only affirming what we saw last night. I wanted to run up and ask them about the group, but before I could, Jane came into the building and pulled me aside, letting me know it was time to go. The entire situation was very eerie, and the lingering thought made it incredibly hard to sleep. I forced Kaylee to talk about the situation on our drive home. Kaylee had agreed to drive me back to the cities. During the trip, I asked her what she thought about what she saw, not mentioning what I overheard between the two girls. Kaylee mentioned that in the Bible, we're both agnostic pagans, by the way, that it mentions that Lucifer will return to Earth wearing all white to exact vengeance. But she felt like it was too big of a coincidence that our attacker was wearing all white. After the reports of cult activity and that revelation, it was solidified for me. I don't know what that guy had in store for us, but I'm glad we got out of there in one piece.
Wow, that was huge. Well, my favorite part is when she goes, yeah, he was wearing all white. All white jacket, all white shirt, all white belt, all white pants, all white shoes. Like, we don't know what all white means.
Yeah, bitch, we know what all
you
white means.
You don't have
means.
To go through every single thing. We know what all white means.
All white.
Stories from Inside a Cult, Part 1.
Let me just start off by saying that I've never been an entirely normal person. I'm doing this for my sister. These are my diary entries from the time that I was in a cult. February 10th. Mom called today. Sarah's in a real pile of shit, apparently. She joined this weird religious group several months ago. At first, it was just meetings and potluck dinners. Then we stopped hearing from her for days at a time, which turned into weeks. This is very unusual for my family. My mother, sister, and I have always been tight, more so since my dad left 10 years ago. We haven't heard from Sarah in 3 weeks. Mom is starting to freak out hardcore. She said she's even tried calling the police, but you can't technically file a missing persons report for someone who just isn't calling. I mentioned going after her to my mom. She hates the idea. I think if I give it a few more days, she'll be a bit more open to it. The last time we heard from her, she was on Montana, on a retreat for this group. They call themselves Elizine. I forced the name out of her one night at the bar, just as she first started getting involved with the group. Google tells me that this has something to do with the ancient Greeks, but I don't get why Sarah would be involved with a group like that. There's not a lot I can do for now. February 12th. Mom finally cracked. She gave me her blessing to head to Montana to see if I can pick up the trail. Maybe she's still at this retreat and hasn't been able to call. Either way, I'm picking up my freelance writing job and heading to Hopetown, Montana. Packing sucks. February 13th. Made it to Hopetown. I rented a cheap hotel room, but it was heating, and that's all I really care about. Okay, I lied. I just found a roach in my room. I care. But I can't afford anything better on a writer's salary, so I'll just have to tough it out. I'm going to start my search for Sarah tonight. Ask around the local restaurant about Helizine. Surely, with a town this small, someone should have heard about them. So I just got back from the local diner. Food sucked, but the strangest thing happened. First off, hardly anybody would look at me, even the waitress. I had to stoop to talk to the old man sitting in the booth next to me. I introduced myself, and I was looking for my sister. Told him that the last anyone heard from her, she was on a retreat with a Helizine in this town. He stared at me long enough to start wondering if he was English speaking, then shook his head. He got up in the middle of his meal and just left. He left all of his food and everything. It was the strangest thing I ever encountered. I asked the waitress, but she literally ran off into the kitchen and refused to speak to me after that. 3 a.m. I was just awoken by a knock at my door. Given the late time, I was slow to get to the door. When I looked through the peephole, that old guy I tried talking to at the diner was standing there, looking like he was about to jump out of his own skin. When I opened the door, curiosity winning out over precaution, a blast of what smelled like whiskey hit me full in the face. The crappy blue hotel lights flickered in the hallway, making him look slightly demonic. He placed a piece of paper in my hand with an address and a time on it, not meeting my eyes, and then turned away and ran off. I have no idea what this address is for, but it obviously has something to do with Sarah. Or he's sending me to a murderer's house to be chopped up into small pieces. Either way, I don't have much of a choice. Needless to say, this is a weird town. I need to find Sarah and get the hell out. Update. I woke up early this morning, February 14th, and decided to try and hack Sarah's Facebook. I figured Facebook is a mecca of her social media presence, and it's not as public as Instagram or Twitter. People don't like to splash cult knowledge all over the internet, just to guess. I know my sister pretty well, but I haven't been able to get it yet. I'll keep working on it and put up what I find later today after my date on the note I got last night. Hopefully I'm not dead by then. Remember, the whole murder thing is still entirely possible.
Ooh, okay, let's get on to part two. Part 2.
February 14th continued. Oh my god, or should I say gods, two major things happened. I managed to hack Sarah's Facebook. I didn't find anything alarming, with the exception of one personal message. It was from a guy named Jared, a casually normal name. The account is deactivated now, or I would have messaged him myself. The message itself was just a single phrase in a strange language, Notisetun. Google, always a ready scholar, tells me it means know thyself. Why Sarah would have someone named Jared messenger such a thing, I have no clue. But it's a start, and I have a name I can use. The second event is the meeting, if you could call it that. I went. I packed pepper spray in my boot just in case. I followed my GPS to the address the old guy gave me. It's about 20 minutes away from the hotel in the middle of nowhere. As I drove farther into the woods, the dread I felt blossomed into full-blown fear, but I kept driving. I had to keep reminding myself I'm doing this for Sarah. I got to the location. It was an old run-down building that looked like a church. It didn't look like anyone had used it for years. Given the sun was setting and the light wasn't very good, it looked like some of the windows were boarded up and the community garden by the gravel parking lot was overrun with weeds. There weren't any other cars in the lot, and I started to feel like driving out to the middle of nowhere had been a bad idea. Of course, I'd also made the idiotic decision of not letting my mom know where I was going. I didn't want it to worry her. Just as I was getting back into my car to leave, a van pulled up next to me in the lot. A short guy got out and walked towards my head. My beat-up Honda, sorry. He looked normal, brown hair, green eyes, no features that screamed serial killer. I casually reached down to grab the pepper spray and held it tight anyway. The guy approached me, but didn't say a word. He just stared at me for the longest time. I started to panic, torn between spraying him in the face and running, or trying to ask him where my sister was. Something in my gut kicked up, screaming at me it would not have been a good idea to bring Sarah up. After what felt like forever, he started to turn away, his face expressionless. I knew I had to do something, the chance of finding Sarah slipping away from me every second I stalled. I blurted out the first thing that came into my mind, the words in that message I read from Facebook, Notisetun. I hope I pronounced it right, and without seeming terrified or speaking words whose weight I knew not. He stopped and turned to look at me. Suddenly a warm smile broke across his face, and he seemed excited. He repeated the phrase back at me and moved to clasp my hands in his, almost as if we were both shaking hands. When he felt the pepper spray in mine, he chuckled. Tomorrow, 8 p.m. He also gave me an address. I guess I passed whatever test that was. I'm back in my hotel room now, trying not to panic over what I might have gotten myself into. I keep having to remind myself that I'm doing it for Sarah, but doubt keeps me wondering if I'm even on the right track. What if this is just another random religious group I happen to have stumbled on, in the same small town? Highly unlikely. Anyways, I'll stop my rambling, my fears out. I'm just nervous for tomorrow. I guess I should get some sleep. I need to be ready for anything. February 15th. I'm back from the 8 p.m. meeting. I'm packing everything frantically and trying to write this quickly so they don't leave without me. The meeting was in some house close to town. There were a few other people there who looked like they also had no idea what was going on. We all sat in a circle and introduced ourselves. The leaders of the meeting asked us what our purpose was in seeking out those that had asked us to come here tonight. I guess I wasn't the only one who was given directions by a random person in an obscure location yesterday. The girl who went first said she was looking for something more in life, more fulfillment. I was next. I decided that sincerely obscuring the truth can be the best form of lying. I introduced myself, saying that I really didn't know what this was all about, but I was also looking for something to help complete my life. I lost someone a while back, someone that meant a lot to me. I needed help recovering from that loss. The whole thing felt a lot like being in an AA meeting. Other than the semi-formality of the atmosphere, everyone appeared normal. The house was average, not creepy. I almost couldn't believe the weirdness of the abandoned church yesterday. After we had gone around the circle giving introductions, we were paired individually with leaders. I got paired with a girl who seemed really excited to be paired with me. Boring old me, a person she didn't even know. She bubbled with enthusiasm as she asked me all about myself, what I do for a living. After I gave her my mini life story, she asked if I had any questions. Hell yes, I did. I asked her what the group was, what they do in practice. In answer to my question, she simply said, "Grace, we're the type of people who like to help others find their way in life. We believe in fulfillment through the gods, that pleasing them helps us find our path. We'd love to help you find your way. I think that you would fit in here well." I told her, great, I couldn't wait. What was the next step? She told me, and I kid you not, the next step is the retreat. The point of the meeting was to find people who are emotionally ready to make the leap. She said she thought I was ready. She expressed that it was important that we leave tonight in order to preserve the emotions brought out tonight and that urge to find something more. Basically, we needed to leave for this retreat before any new people could develop a sense of caution and change their minds about the whole thing. I played my part, though, and agreed to meet back at the house as soon as I grabbed a bag from the hotel with enough clothes to last a few days. I am only allowed to bring my phone and clothes. I'll try leaving my laptop with the front desk and ask them to ship it to my house. We'll see if it ever makes it home. I have doubts. I just called Mom to let her know everything. She went crazy when I told her about the retreat, yelling that it was a stupid idea. I agreed with her, but reminded her of Sarah, and that we really don't have any other options. She said to hang on. She would fly up and we could go together. I told her no, that wouldn't work. The only way I got in on this was from some random old guy who hooked me up with these meetings. I told her that bringing an outsider with me wouldn't grant me the same access. She agreed only after I promised to text call her about any weirdness happening. She had assured me that if she didn't hear from me within 12 hours, she'd be calling the police again. I've been thinking of the old guy from the diner. I haven't figured him out since I last saw him. He wasn't at any of the meetings. Obviously, he has some connection with his group, the people who call themselves Helizine. I haven't let it slip that I know the name. My gut instinct was to play dumb about everything at the meeting. We'll see if that ruse works long enough to get me through this retreat. I don't know if I believe in God or the gods, if there are multiple. But if you do, please pray for me. I will update when I can. And that was it. There was no
updates. And then he never updated.
There was no more updates.
Well, he's dead.
Yep.
Damn.
She, I think it was she. Her name's Grace.
Oh, right. Well, Grace, it was a good story. Thank you so much for submitting.
<Just kidding. laughs> Oh, no, Grace.
Okay, great. And then we have another one coming up, right?
Yes.
All right, here comes the next one, you guys. Monanthian's Nest, Part 1.
I was no sculptor. Heck, I was no artist. As a child, I couldn't sketch, paint, color, or create anything of any artistic worth. And now that I'm in my mid-30s, well, I still can't. Everyone knows that about me. I remember being 13 years old and watching with a jealous gaze as Miles Baker worked with his carving tool. What began as a gray, rectangular piece of clay had transformed into a layered and spherical shape that resembled a hornet's nest. Miles' eyes pinched, and he carved with precision and intensity. He worked like a child possessed. Every student in the class only paid half attention to their own projects. Every few seconds they'd look up, and their eyes glistened with this sort of quiet awe. No one looked at me with those eyes. I was a bit aloof, a bit of a troublemaker, not quite withdrawn, not quite the class clown. I regularly took ADHD pills, and my sleep behavior was irregular. There was no predicting how I'd act on a day-to-day basis, and when I was motivated, it wasn't necessarily to do the right thing. One inspired day, I invented a series of baseball third base coach-like hand signals to communicate silently with other students in class. Tap your left ear, swipe your forehead, reach across the chest, and touch your left shoulder with your right fist. There were at least 10 signals. The teacher went nuts, and I found myself in the principal's office yet again. It was a familiar place. I just wanted to be like Miles. He had such talent, so many gifts. He finished his sculpture, and it was a true work of art. He called it Monanthian's Nest, and it quickly found its way into the display case by the front office in our school. The piece was about 14 inches high, and dozens of faces were carved into the nest with exact precision. Each face was unique, and they were frozen in expressions of surprise and terror. It was almost hypnotizing to look at. I thought about the name often, Monanthian. I wondered what it meant, but I was too sheepish to ask Miles. For some reason, I thought he'd be offended. I caught myself stopping to look at the Monanthian's Nest sculpture far too often. I wish I could create something like that, to be as revered as Miles. But I wasn't that type of kid. I didn't have the talent. I was mocked, even by those who should have been above that sort of thing. One day I lingered too long in the hallway to study Miles' sculpture, rooted in place past the ringing of the school bell. The principal turned the corner, and he reached across his chest and touched his left shoulder, one of the many baseball signs that had landed me in hot water merely a week before. His eyes lasered in on me. "Get to class," he muttered. I slinked away, filled with a mixture of embarrassment and anger. Even my own principal is mocking me, I remember thinking. And that was the moment I decided to turn it around. I studied more, tried harder, not just in school, but in all areas. I even stepped up my game in catechism classes. Miles was also in my class at church. Oh, catechism. Sorry, guys. I even stepped up my game in catechism classes. Miles was also in my class at church. His mere presence pushed me to be a better person. I went from the kid who constantly peppered the teacher with half-grinned queries like, "Do dogs go to heaven?" to memorizing and delivering the Nicene Creed in front of the entire congregation. Even Miles had an impressed smile on his face that day. The invitation came shortly thereafter. Miles asked me if I wanted to sleep over at his house the following Saturday night. He was inviting a few kids from our church, and he'd have pizzas and movies. I quickly accepted. My father, though, expressed his displeasure. "I don't want you spending time with the Bakers," he firmly told me. "That entire family is bad news." My father, not a religious man, launched into a laundry list of the hypocritical actions the Baker clan did. His eyes burned and his voice cut with an extra edge as he railed against the Baker patriarch. The man preaches the word of God and judges every person he lays his eyes on. Yet he has been abusing the bottle for 30 years. Everyone knows it. But that piece of work will cast public shame upon anyone else that even sniffs booze in public. He even has an illegitimate daughter in Texas. I bet you didn't know that. And the eldest son, the one up in Madison, he's an adulterer and has his own out-of-wedlock child. But they're certainly quick to cover up those minor indiscretions. Lord knows how many other secrets are buried and hidden away. I won't let my son be poisoned by these people. No way. But my father got sent off on a business trip that weekend, and my mother, well, she didn't raise objections. She was the one who strongly insisted I go to church and eventually get confirmed in the first place. She practically dragged me out of bed every Sunday morning, and I think she saw how much this invitation mattered to me. I didn't get invited to get-togethers often. I was improving, academically and socially, and this was important. She warmly smiled and insisted that I go. "Don't tell your father," she said. I certainly wasn't planning on it.
Is that the end of part one?
That's the end of part one.
Okay, let's go to part two. Part two.
I didn't know what to expect as I rang the doorbell to the Baker home, backpack slung over my shoulder and sleeping bag under my arm. Miles lived on the edge of town in a private neighborhood. His house sat on what must have been 5 acres of land, his backyard directly backing up to the forest. I shouldn't have been nervous, but I was. This was my chance to fit in and get more insight in how to be more like Miles. Creative, intelligent, artistic Miles. The door opened, and the first thing I noticed was a large portrait of Jesus, his head covered in a white hood. He was gently feeding the sheep and holding a shepherd's crook. Miles stood off in the doorway. I looked back, waved, and my mom backed out of the driveway and drove off. The Baker home had a distinct smell, a churchy sort of smell, old and stale. Religious artifacts littered the main floor, tabletop wooden crosses, ancient candles, and paintings of old men in white beards. Buried in between a set of medieval chalices inside a massive armoire, I spotted another sculpture, a Manutheian's nest. A near-identical version of what Miles had created in class. The faces seemed to cry out to me. I studied it for a moment, marveling at his intricacies. "I made this one too," Miles said. "It's weird. When I sculpt, I don't feel like I'm creating something out of that block of clay. It feels like the object is already inside of it, fully formed. I'm just destroying the shell and allowing it to be free." It was remarkably personal, and no one had ever talked to me like that before. It felt like Miles had shared some intimate knowledge with me, and I may have even blushed. I finally worked up the courage and I asked Miles what Manutheian meant. "Doesn't mean anything," he shrugged. "I made it up. I just thought it sounded cool and mysterious." Minutes ticked by, then an hour. Miles and I watched TV in the basement and talked about school, church, and even girls. He told me about his creative process and how he hoped to study art in Europe. No one else had arrived. It was just me and Miles. Mrs. Baker called down to us for dinner, and the aroma of hot cheese and tomato sauce wafted downstairs. It was a welcome respite. Even the basement smelled like a sanctuary. The table was set for four, the Baker parents, Miles, and me. No one else was coming, Mrs. Baker told us. They'd all called to cancel. I didn't remember hearing a phone ring. Mrs. Baker was dressed plainly in blue clothes, and Mr. Baker wore pleated khakis and a slightly ill-fitting red flannel shirt. I moved towards one end of the table, and Mrs. Baker smiled and pulled out a different chair for me. "Our special guest gets the best seat in the house," she said. Every chair looked pretty much the same, but who was I to argue? Mrs. Baker, Miles, and I had clear glasses eliminated by our plates. Mr. Baker had a black coffee mug. The cup was not steaming. My thoughts immediately shifted to my father, and I heard his voice in my head telling me that there sure wasn't coffee or tea in that mug. Mr. Baker lifted the mug and took a satisfying gulp, smacking his lips together when he was finished. He noticed me watching him, and my eyes darted away. I grabbed my glass of lemonade, took a long drink, and I noticed my hand shaking. The table conversation began innocently enough, but the topics soon shifted to religion and faith. Mrs. Baker beamed as I told her about how much I'd been studying and the gains I made, and she even had me recite her favorite part of the Nicene Creed. When you stood up in front of the whole congregation, that was one of my favorite days, she said. Mr. Baker continued drinking from his black mug and left to refill it from the kitchen 2, 3, 4 times. He wobbled just a little more noticeably each time. He kept silent, cutting his pizza with a knife and a fork and chewing each piece meticulously. And every so often, he leered at me, studied me. He constantly narrowed his eyes and grimaced, like he doubted every word I was saying. I fidgeted in my seat each time. Finally, Mr. Baker spoke. But he wasn't talking to the table. He was more talking at the table. He just wanted an audience. He went on about a few people, his mailman's gay son, the Henderson's girl's alleged abortion, and his co-worker's drinking problem. All godless people, soulless, no direction, no purpose. His head snapped at me. And what do you think? He asked. I tipped my glass back and nervously finished my lemonade, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw Mr. Baker grin ever so slightly. Mrs. Baker looked over at him, her eyes silently asking Mr. Baker for approval or agreement in something. He stared back at her, and they shared something unspoken. Miles shifted uncomfortably in his seat and looked away. Something didn't feel right. No, nothing felt right. I suddenly regretted being there, hated being there. I despised the smell and the crosses everywhere, and the eyes of all of the religious figures in the paintings cast judgment upon me. My head was spinning, slowly at first, and then faster and faster. I looked over at Monithian's nest, and I swore it was vibrating, like 1,000 insects were about to break free and engulf me in a tornado of hornet fury. I got it together. I regained my senses a bit, and I opened my eyes. Monithian's nest sat unmoving. Mr. Baker's chair squeaked, and he looked at me. He'd been backing away from the table, but he stopped, cold. "What are you drinking, Mr. Baker?" I asked. I grinned slyly. My words dripped with intent. I'm not sure why I was so brazen. It just came out of me. I heard my father's voice in my head imploring me to stand up to Mr. Baker. My father's warnings and trepidations about the Bakers had finally bubbled to the surface. My father was right. These people were bad news. Mr. Baker didn't answer. His gaze shifted between me and Mrs. Baker. I didn't let him respond. Instead, I excused myself, and I stumbled downstairs, collapsing on my sleeping bed. I wanted to gather my things and call home, but I couldn't will myself to do it. My head spun with greater intensity, and I thought about the safety of my own house, my own bed, and I was almost glued to my sleeping bag. I wonder if I'd been drugged, but my mind couldn't make the proper connections. My body begged to pass out, but something was fighting it. Was it my ADHD? I was practically an insomniac because of my meds. Maybe the medicine was counteracting the drugs, or maybe my pills were wearing off and my mind was returning to its hyper-alert state, or perhaps the drugs just didn't work on me. Who knows? I just lay motionless, unable to fall asleep, and unable to pretty much do anything else.
Ooh, because he's all cracked out on Adderall.
Is that what it is?
So the drugs ain't working. Part 3.
Hours passed. At some point, the door to the basement creaked open, and I saw a sliver of light creep through. The hushed voices of the baker spilled into the basement, and I could only make out 2 fragments. He is not of pure faith. His blood will not satisfy. The door shut, and I willed myself to get up. My body fought whatever happened to me, and I lurched to my feet. I thought about grabbing my stuff and hightailing it home, but I was curious. I wanted to know what was going on. Footsteps echoed above me on the first floor. I heard the front door open and shut. I figured I was alone in the house, but I didn't take any chances. I unlocked the basement window, slid it open, and I climbed out into the window well. Shaking off my dizziness, I pulled myself up and outside. My breath fogged the slightly chilly air, and the dampness of the ground soaked through my socks. I wasn't wearing shoes. I turned towards home. It would be about a 40-minute jog, but something else caught my attention. the Baker family was taking a midnight hike into the woods. I thought about my safety and my mother's embrace, but again, I thought about my father. "Follow them," I heard him say. "Discover what secrets they have buried away." Against my better judgment, I listened to the voice in my head. I entered the forest and trailed the Bakers at a safe distance, mindful of each and every stride. One crack of a twig or one errant step would give me away. I often stopped and peered around long trees, reconsidering my course of action, but adrenaline won the moment and I'd push forward. I relied on the noises of the Bakers trampling through the dark woods. The moon was full, and rays of light peeked through the foliage above. I gained confidence with each and every step, the effects of whatever happened to me earlier wearing off by the minute. I heard rumblings ahead. I ascended a small hill and I found myself looking down on a congregation of about 100 people in a small clearing. The crowd stood arm in arm, maybe 10 rows deep. They were chanting softly, all facing a large tree. I was looking directly at the backs of the chanters, and I considered moving to get a better vantage point. Just who was down there? I turned to make my way silently across the hill, but my eyes caught something else. I stopped dead in my tracks. Everyone in the crowd was looking at the same thing, and I finally spotted it up in the tree. It was a familiar sight. Monithian's nest. But it was the real thing. It was about 30 feet off the ground, hanging off of a branch near the center of the tree. The nest was much larger than Miles' sculpture. It looked to be about 5 feet long and 2 feet wide. It was difficult to tell in the darkness, but I swore I could see the faces etched into the nest. Those screaming, horrified faces that Miles had recreated ever so delicately in art class. Bodies swayed and a sea of chanters parted in the center. Three people approached the tree from the back row, each carrying what looked like a passed-out child in his arms. They slowly advanced towards the nest. The children held out like offerings to an altar. The nest pulsated, slowly at first, and then with increased vigor, as the three people neared the tree. The chanting intensified, and the arms of the congregation raised in unison. The nest shook violently and started to break apart. Something was forcing its way out. The chanting became louder and deeper. For a moment, I forgot where I was. I was entranced, and it felt like I was back in front of the school's display case, staring spellbound at Miles' sculpture. My foot slipped in the mud, and a small rock tumbled down the hill. A head turned towards me from the outermost row, then another. I wasn't sure if they'd seen me, but it was a wake-up call I needed. I stumbled backwards and fell to the ground. I popped up and hightailed it down the hills toward the Baker's house. Just as hideous and high-pitched screeched echoed through the night. My legs chugged and churned, my lungs were aflame, and my eyes burned with tears. I tore through the woods, running only on instinct, hoping I was heading in the right direction, but not sure if I was only heading deeper into the abyss of the forest. Somehow, I made it back into the Baker's backyard. I collapsed onto the ground, and I sobbed. Just a 13-year-old kid bawling his eyes out, not quite sure of the magnitude of the horrific scene he had just witnessed. I eventually staggered to my feet, covered in mud. I ambled to the window well, climbed back inside through the window, and collapsed into my sleeping bag. I couldn't leave. They would know that I'd seen. They'd know that I bore witness to the ceremony and heard the terrible wail of whatever emerged from that nest. I had to pretend I'd been sleeping the whole time. I made some fast decisions. I stripped off my muddy clothes and I pulled on some clean shorts and a t-shirt. I cleaned up the debris I tracked into the basement and made sure the window well looked as undisturbed as possible and washed my muddy clothes in the basement sink. My heart sank when I realized I was missing a sock. I had gone through the whole ordeal without shoes and my sock must have come off in the woods. I cursed my carelessness and said a quick prayer that no one would stumble across it amongst the trees. I slipped into my sleeping bag and I waited. It was 3 a.m. I considered the possibilities of how I'd be caught and I remembered one crucial element, footprints. Were my tracks plainly visible in the grass? My stomach dropped. Almost at the very instant, raindrops began peppering the house, and it quickly turned into a downpour. I took it as a sign I was getting through this. Against all odds, I fell asleep.
Whoa, what do you mean against all odds? How are you falling asleep when you just saw all this weird stuff and you're cracked out?
Against all odds.
Okay, against all odds. Part 4.
I awoke to the smells and sounds of crackling bacon from upstairs. I rolled up my sleeping bag, grabbed my stuff, and I climbed the basement steps. I was greeted merrily by Mrs. Baker, who handed me a plate of breakfast. I took my seat at the kitchen table next to Miles, whose plate was full of food was half eaten. He nibbled on some sausage links and mumbled a cheerful good morning through the bites of the food. Mr. Baker strode into the kitchen, kissed Mrs. Baker on the cheek, and took a seat at the table with a newspaper. It was all very normal, very all-American. You'd have never thought some nefarious nest-worshipping and human sacrifice had gone on the night before. I almost doubted the whole thing had happened. My mother arrived to pick me up 30 minutes later. Miles stopped me right before I headed out the doorway. He handed me a muddy sock. My sock. "I found this," he said. Terror filled me, but it dissipated quickly. Miles' eyes were soft. He didn't have his father's rage. I nodded and headed outside. To say my life changed after this was an understatement. I was very wary of every single person around me. How many people in my life had linked up arm in arm to worship the nest and the tree? I resolved to never tell a soul, not even my own mother. After all, she had encouraged me to sleep over at the Baker home. As awful as the thought was, she could have been in on it. If anyone suspected that I knew about the wall in the woods, or the children that were carried to the nest, or if Miles decided to tell somebody about what he found, it was simply too dangerous. I was a threat. I decided to carry the secret with me for as long as I lived, but I had to make some changes. I acted out more in class. Gone was a new studious me. Back was a slacker, devil-may-care attitude. It was a return to form, and in my mind, it relieved suspicion. I dropped out of my church classes, which seemed to relieve my father, but he never directly gave me a pat on the back. My mother wouldn't allow that. It was just something about what I'd heard the Baker say in that hallway. He is not of pure faith. His blood will not satisfy. I reasoned being as ungodly as possible was the safest bet for my survival. I drifted away from Miles, and within a few months, we weren't speaking at all. As I slacked off in my studies, Miles had only improved. At my last day of church class, he had wowed the other students with a dramatic retelling of the creation story. He soon was accepted to an art program overseas, and he was gone. At least that's what everyone said. But mainly, I tried to forget. I tried to fool myself into thinking the ceremony never happened. I grew up. Middle school, high school, college. I tried to forget it all, and in a way, I almost did. The more years passed, the more the incident receded into the deepest recesses of my memory. By the time I was married with an 8-year-old son of my own, the ceremony in Monithian's nest seemed like something out of a dream. In a way, I began to doubt that the experience had occurred. It was a legend, the stuff of imagination of a 13-year-old kid long since grown up. But as often is the case, incidents we think are buried have this remarkable way of crawling to the surface.
Oh, I can't wait. I feel like something's going to happen with this kid, his friend. Man. I feel like something's definitely going to happen. So this next part is the last part,
right? This is the next part, the last part.
With the next part being the last part, you guys, we have some simple announcements for you. Make sure you go check out All Things Scary after this, where we talk about Courage the Cowardly Dog and all these like weird conspiracy theories involving the show, and then also give us 5 stars on iTunes. It really does help us out because, you know, we do this podcast for free. So why don't you help us out? Give us 5 stars. And do we have any shows coming up? Fresno. Yeah,
Fresno this Saturday.
Fresno this Saturday.
January 26, 2019.
And big thank you to all the uglies who came to the last show in North Hollywood. It was so great to meet all of you guys. And we sent you some stickers. Okay, so without further ado, let's get to the last part. Part 5.
I was 36 years old and I had just accepted a job across the country in the Pacific Northwest. I moved out to Oregon with my wife and son, and we were exploring the local churches in town. I had no interest in attending a church. I wasn't a religious man, but I tagged along with my wife and son. We sat in the office of the pastor, and my eyes scanned the religious artifacts in a display on the far wall. Buried amongst the collection was a sculpture of Monithian's nest. I choked up, unable to breathe. The memories came flooding back, each more vivid than the last. As the pastor talked to us about the congregation, services, and volunteering opportunities, my gaze constantly shifted to the nest. The meeting was a blur. When it ended, the pastor walked us out to the door. My family exited first, but before I could slip out the door, the pastor touched my arm. I turned, and he nodded at the artifact collection. He knew that I knew. Panic filled me, but the pastor only smiled, and he made a familiar motion. He reached across his chest and touched his left shoulder with his right fist. The sign! It suddenly became clear. All those years ago, the principal wasn't mocking me. He thought I was one of them, one of the worshipers. And for the first time in years, I opened my eyes. I started seeing people again. Instead of trying to forget that the incident occurred, I embraced it. And I started seeing it everywhere. At a party at my new neighbor's house, a small painting of Monithian's nest sat on a bookshelf. Two neighbors discreetly gave themselves a sign. I spotted a small figurine at a barber shop, a drawing at a coffee shop, watercolor sketches and doodles on refrigerators. And all around me, the whispers. I was finally attuned. I met a guy today. His blood will be extra ripe. She's believed in God all her life. Can we bring her to the nest? Pure faith. She believes. It only takes the true believers. We are the sculptors, my brother. Molding the world. Sculptors. I fully realized the world in which I lived, in which we all lived. And I only had one thought. I must protect my son. He must never be given to the creature that emerged from the nest that night. There may have been thousands of these creatures, these Monithians. I'd moved 2,000 miles away and Monithian's nest had followed me. I didn't know how many there were, and I'm not sure I wanted to know. All that mattered was my boy's safety. And so my mission continues. Not long ago, my wife opened a box in our basement and she discovered an interesting item. Miles' sculpture of Monithian's nest from decades ago. I forgot I had it. Not long after the incident in the woods, I sneaked into the school late at night. I smashed the display case by the front office, carefully lifted out Monithian's nest and placed it in a box. I proceeded to destroy every piece of art in that case, save the nest, and left them all in thousands of pieces on the hallway floor. It was a total carnage to whoever cleaned it up. Every single student's art piece was shattered beyond recognition. I needed my own Monithian's nest. I remember thinking, this may come in handy one day. I might need to prove myself to the others so that they don't offer me or eliminate me. I looked upon the nest for the first time in over 20 years, the one that had started me on my journey. I studied it, that familiar hypnotizing effect taking me once more. Such precision, such detail, dozens of faces, all screaming in surprise or terror. And I noticed one I didn't remember before. Maybe I never looked closely enough. It was Miles's face, frozen in a horrified scream. I placed the nest on the bookshelf in our family room. It's best everyone sees it, so they don't suspect anything. I even give the sign when I notice a neighbor gazing upon it. Anything to keep my boys safe. But I'm not one of them. No way. My wife asked me if I was the one who carved the nest, but she knew better than anyone. I don't have an artistic bone in my body. Hand me a block of clay and I'm useless. I could never destroy the shell and allow something to be free. I'm no sculptor.
Oh, wow. That was so interesting. I wonder if that's true. I feel like it could be true.
Yeah. Yeah,
there have to be secret organizations. There has have to be.
And cults.
Yeah, or cults. Yeah, secret organizations, cults, Illuminati stuff. There have to be those things.
What's like a white supremacists things. Do the little handshake with a tap-tap on the wrist?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, sorry.
I guess I'm not in on that one.
No?
Nah. But anyways, you guys, thank you so much for listening to True Scary Stories with Edie. Now is a great time to go join the Facebook group at True Scary Stories with Edie and go check out All Things Scary, our show on YouTube, for more scary stuff.
Yeah.
And give us 5 stars on iTunes.
And follow us on everything at Nick Comic, at Edie Gibson Comedy.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.